And perhaps fortunately I'll get a bit of a jump on things and tell you that I don't work for the government. Yes, Pfizer has paid me money to give a version of this talk, and if somebody else wants to give me money to give a version of this talk, please come talk with me. But I want to talk with you today about a different issue. I'm a bioinformatician. What that means is that I deal every day with assays that give me thousands of measurements for every given patient. And the general excitement associated with that, once we get past the disclosure, has to do with the fact that high-throughput biology has this promise. It has this promise that if only we can put together these hundreds of things into some coherent pattern, because the biology is complex, then maybe we can tell something new about the clinical outcomes. And in particular, I'm working in an oncology field, so we're trying to say, how can we put together measures of thousands of genes to tell us something new about how cancer works, or even better, how cancer responds to treatment or things like that. However, there is a drawback, and you knew this was coming because this is the controversy section. The controversy is that when we moved these thousands of assays and things like that, and there is complexity, there is power there, there is wonderful stuff there, but we are paying a price, and one price that we are paying is intuition. And what I mean by that is I work with a bunch of clinicians who have very good understanding about how certain genes are associated with outcome. They've worked with those genes for decades. On the other hand, I can tell you, those same individuals have no intuition whatsoever when it comes to the behavior of an ensemble of 200 genes. Nobody does. So there is the issue that if we're going to use such ensembles, we really need to be sure that we are able to trust the underlying mathematics and analysis that produced them. That is the reproducibility argument, and actually this is the reproducibility being a hallmark of science that was brought up just a moment ago, but here I'm not even going to talk about reproducing it in a different study. I'm just going to talk about the issue of saying, starting from the same numerical data, is the analysis from that point on described well enough for somebody else to get the same results? And the thing is, in high throughput studies, based on microarrays, the answer for the most part is no. And what that leads to in many cases is the case that, well, somebody will come to somebody like me, who's a bioinformatician, and say, hey, there's this thing that I'd really like to do. Can you figure out how to do it? And of course, we get to then reverse engineer or apply forensic bioinformatics or find your favorite phrase to figure out what the heck was actually done. And in this context, we're going to look at the question of, can we predict patient response to chemotherapeutics? And the reason we're going to look at this is that there was a paper that appeared in a high-profile journal, Nature Medicine, a few years ago, where they contended that they'd figured out how to do this. What they said was, they said, let's start with a common panel of cell lines, not even patient samples. We can take these samples, the cell lines, and we can order them according to their sensitivity to treatment with a given drug. We can say which ones are most sensitive to docetaxel, which ones are most resistant, fine. Then, given that panel of cell lines, we'll take the extremes, the most resistant, the most sensitive, we will use microarrays to make thousands of measurements, our gene measurements, we'll identify the ones that are most different, and we will use those to construct a sensitivity signature. We'll then take a microarray profile of a patient sample, look for the presence of that signature, and if it's there, we'll say, my gosh, this patient is likely to respond to docetaxel. And the reason this made it into this journal and got high-profile stuff about it is that they said, we went back, we looked at retrospective stuff with 7 commonly used agents, and we got great results. And empirically, we had several groups at MD Anderson come to us and say, we want to do this. So of course, we said, sure, we will try. So we went out, we went to the common panel. We went out, we said, okay, for this common panel, let's pick the most sensitive and most resistant cell lines to docetaxel, and let's construct a model based on this. And the model gives us results sort of like this for the cell lines. This is principal components, and all I'm doing is I'm saying, if I start with docetaxel, and of the thousands I've got, I pick the 50 that separate the most, I can cluster all the resistance at the left and all the sensitives at the right, and quite frankly, this shouldn't surprise you. This is just the cell line data. This is the training data. I picked the genes so that I could do that. The fun thing is now that I've got this model, I want to take the test data, the patient data, project it into the same space, and see that it separates, like they claimed that it did. So we took the patient data and we projected it, and unfortunately it wound up right here in the center. So we said, okay, well, maybe we did something wrong. So we decided to follow up. So what we did was we said, all right, well, they said one of the drugs they looked at was 5-fluorouracil. So let's look at that one more carefully. In particular, let's look at the genes that they use, or the genes that they say are important for 5-fluorouracil. And this should be easy because together with the paper, there's a list that says, here's the Affymetrix probes that I use. Here's the genes that are used. And what we want to be able to reproduce is a figure like this. This is a heat map that was actually in the Nature Medicine paper. It shows that they used 45 genes, and for every single one of those genes, the gene was either high in one group of samples and then low in the other, or low then high. These are the sensitive resistant things. Fine. Okay, well, we took the arrays, we took their 12,000 things. Congratulations, I am a PhD trained biostatistician. I can do t-tests on 12,000 things. So we picked out the top 45 by t-tests, and here's our heat map, and we said, wow, this is wonderful. So we then went back and we said, okay, let's take their list of 45 genes, construct the heat map with those 45, and said, okay, something's a bit weird here. So we stare at this a bit more, and after staring at it a bit more, we tried something simple, which is we went out and we simply listed the probe sets they reported and the ones we obtained. And as you go from left to right, you may notice a simple pattern here, and yes, indeed, we have an off by one indexing error. So what we've got is we've got a list of 45 that works great in their hands. Now, I'll tell you something else about that paper. In the paper, there are statements saying, by the way, here are the following signatures, and here's why the following genes make sense. Now, all the genes they're referring to are all the wrong ones, but they make sense. Now, of course, this is one drug. They looked at 7. What happens with the other 6? Well, let's see. I'm looking at p-values for the off by one things. So basically what this says is for every single thing that they got for topotecan, they're all off by one. Etoposide, all off by one. Adriamycin, mostly off by one. There's a few we can't explain. Paclitaxel, mostly off by one. Docetaxel, mostly off by one. And Cytoxan, we have no earthly idea what they did with this drug. So there's a bit of a problem here, but fine. Now, how could this happen? Well, in order to address that, we went down and tracked out not just the data, but we actually tracked down the code. And if you want to read the documentation for the code, you should come to my website, not theirs, because I wrote it, because none existed before. And in the process of writing that code, we figured out that their code needed 2 inputs to work. The first input was a quantification matrix, samples by genes, with a header row that indicated, is the sample sensitive or resistant or a test sample? Fine. The second input is a list of gene names in the same order. But, and here's the kicker, for their software to work correctly, that second input, the list of names, must not have a header row. So if you cut and you paste from Excel and you include the header row, guess what happens? You get an off by one indexing error. And of course, we tried this with docetaxel, and yes, we got off by one genes, and we got the exact heat map they reported. And actually, that was pretty reassuring, so we tried it with the other drugs. So here's the other drugs. So here's the heat maps that we get from their software. Here's the ones reported in the paper. So topotecan is a perfect match. Adriamycin's perfect. Etoposide perfect. 5-FU perfect. Paclitaxel. Well, actually, they mislabeled it as cyclophosphamide in the paper, but okay. And cyclophosphamide, we still have no idea what they did with this drug. So as it is, we can perfectly match the heat maps for 6 of their 7 drugs. Now, this should bother you. And the reason it should bother you is that we perfectly match heat maps for 6, but we perfectly match geneless for 3. There were 3 others that had some other genes that came from somewhere else that we didn't understand. But we'll come back to that because we got excited by something else the software gave us, which was predictions. Now, in terms of predictions, they said, okay, here's the fraction we got right. So we looked at the paper and we said, can we get predictions as good as the ones they got? So we said, how good are their predictions? So this top panel is from the Nature Medicine paper. So here's the scores they get for sensitive patients. They're mostly low. Here's the scores they get for resistant ones. They're mostly high. And if you go through and you do something basic like count the number of sensitives, you say 10, 11, 12, 13. There are 13 sensitive patients and 11 resistant ones. Okay, great. But there's just one problem. You see this bottom panel? It doesn't come from the Nature Medicine paper. This bottom panel comes from a paper by Chang et al. The thing that's special about that panel, that paper, this is the paper that actually introduced the test set they're trying to predict. And the thing is, Chang et al. Thought they had 11 sensitive and 13 resistant, not 13 and 11. So we were a bit worried about this, so we decided to look at a different drug, which is adriamycin, and take my word for it, you can indeed count all the individual little red triangles here, but the main thing I want to point out for you is that there's a ton more red triangles than blue squares here. So basically, they've got a whole bunch of patients who are resistant to adriamycin. The problem is the paper from which these data were taken is a paper on childhood leukemia, for which our cure rates are good. If we had this many patients resistant to a drug, we wouldn't be using it. And as a matter of fact, the people supplying that paper thought that most of their patients were sensitive. What's going on here? Well, the way that they are coding sensitive and resistant is 0 and 1, but they've never written it down anywhere. So in one case, we think we've got the labels reversed. Now, what does this mean clinically? It means we're going to prescribe Adriamycin just to the patients who won't benefit from it. That is a bad clinical decision. So this is not a good thing. So how on earth are they getting good predictions? Well, there are those other genes that we can't explain. And actually, we looked at those in the case of docetaxel. Docetaxel, they report 50. When we start with those 50 and we do our off by one trick, we match 31. For those good at subtraction, that leaves 19. So we said, what's special about those 19? We went back to the paper that supplied the test data and said, what did they tell us? Well, they said, here's a list of 92 that'll separate our data. So we looked at the 19 and said, are any of those in the 92? Yep, turns out 14 of them are. The 14 are in one contiguous block, 7 through 20. Side note, for the probabilists in the audience, if you pick 14 items from a list of 92, what are the odds they are all right next to each other? The p-value is small, that's right. Okay, now what's special about the other five? Well, here are the five names. It turns out those names are what's special because those are the five genes mentioned by name in the paper to explain why this signature works. So we have the genes that work to split the test data, the genes that work to split the training data, and the genes that are there to explain why it works. And there's no overlap between the three. So we think this is a problem. So indeed, what we did was we submitted a letter to this effect to Nature Medicine. And since I'm talking about reproducible research, you don't have to take my word for it. You can go there. You can read the paper. Even better, you can cite the paper. That'll make me famous and my mom happy. So that's great. But you can also download all of our reports and our code. You can run it yourselves, and you will get the same numbers. And that's the thing we're striving for. So we said, okay, this is still clinically important. Is there a response? Well, yeah, there was a response. And they said, well, no, your analysis is screwed up. Our data is actually correct. We've posted more detailed results for Adriamycin. That's the one with all the red triangles. And we've gotten it to work again in other high-profile papers, so we must be right. Well, okay, so we looked at the data for Adriamycin. This is where they got them all right. And one of the things we did was we took all the samples that were there and we checked all the pairwise correlations. I'm showing you a plot of the really high ones here. Here's the training data. These are the cell lines. Here's the test data. These are the patient samples. The red dots along the main diagonal, what those are saying are that we have the truism that samples are indeed well correlated with themselves. Okay, good. We expect that. The red dots off the main diagonal, however, those tell us something different. What those tell us is that actually, while they started off with 122 test samples, the problem is they're not all distinct. They've got some samples where they've reused the same sample 2, 3, or even 4 times to build their model. Even better, right about here, column 32, it's really wonderful. They've got one patient used 4 times who is resistant 3 times out of 4. So I'm pretty sure their labels aren't correct yet. So, well, they've also moved to validating in the literature. So here's a paper that showed up in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And in this paper, they extended it to deal with 2 new drugs, cisplatin and pemetrexed, really important for lung cancer. And it's really cool because they said, using these arrays, we found in our signature for cisplatin that ERCC1, ERCC4, and DNA repair genes are involved in the signature. This was a big selling point because there had just been papers in the New England Journal saying ERCC1 is related to cisplatin resistance. Well, with some work, and this is a rather gross abbreviation of time, we perfectly matched the heat maps here too. We know what the genes are. We know what the cell lines are. And when we start and we look at their signature for cisplatin, we can match 41 of the 45 genes after we account for the off by one error that is still there. So there are 4, however, that we can't match. Do I have any guesses from the audience as to the identities of those 4? Turns out the 4 that we cannot match are 4 probe sets, which are for ERCC1, ERCC4, ERCC1, and 1 for FANC-M. Now, of course, of these 4, the last 2 are even better because these last 2 aren't even physically present on the arrays that they use. They're on a different platform entirely. So we're really curious as to how 2 of their best genes they haven't measured yet. So that's a bit of a problem. Now, of course, all of this I want to give you in some context. This started back in 2006, and we've been going back and forth in the journals in 07, 08, 09. Yes, this is a long, ongoing saga. And we're trying to say, you know, this really is sort of disturbing to us, but it's about to get worse. And it's about to get worse around middle of 2009. What made it worse is that around middle of 2009 is when we found out they'd already started running clinical trials using these rules to allocate patients to treatment arms, including drugs where, according to the data they had posted, they had reversed the sensitive and resistant labels. We thought this was a problem. So what do? We wrote up our results. We sent it off first to a high-profile biological journal, whose response was, your story is too negative. Can you fix that? So we instead sent it to a good statistical journal, which said, okay, we'll take it as is, and they posted it online 2 weeks later. I'm sending more papers there. And within a month or two, basically, the story got covered by the Cancer Letter and Duke, which is where the three clinical trials in question were being running, started an internal investigation and suspended the trials. Okay, whew. That was end of last year. We think we're in good shape. So now we're going to get to 2010, and in particular, in January, when Duke said, well, we finished our report and we're happy with it, so we're going to restart the trials because we're confident that this approach works. And we said, could you show us the data? Because we obviously got it wrong. And they said, no, we believe that, we agree to share it with the NCI, but we think it's a confidential report, so we won't show it to you. Now, there was just one more thing, which is that, okay, this was January. One thing that we hadn't made public by that point was that the Duke group, that these investigators conducting these studies, had actually posted new data for cisplatin and pemetrexed in November of 2009, while the investigation was ongoing and while they were trying to sell another clinical trial using these two drugs. Problem is, that data set used 59 validation samples. All 59 samples were mislabeled. We reported this to Duke, to the investigation, and to the NCI in November, and we were really wondering if there was a problem this big, why they were restarting trials. So we asked them about it in January, and there was no response. So then we thought, what else can we do? And then we thought more about the way they declined to show us the data. They said, well, we agreed to share the data with the NCI. And then it occurred to us that the NCI is a federally funded agency. So, indeed, we requested the report under the Freedom of Information Act. And we got the data and we stared at it and we found out that the information that's in that report says nothing about these new problems. It also says that when the review committee looked at the literature, they couldn't figure out how it was done. So we didn't really think that this justified restarting the trial. So we asked the NCI about this, and the NCI said, well, we don't think we're that happy with that group, so we're going to pull some other trials of theirs right now. But we're not going to pull those three because we don't fund those. And we waited for some reaction from Duke, and there was no reaction. So we said, okay, is there anything else we can do? Anything else scientific whatsoever? And the answer was no. See, something else came from out of left field. What came from out of left field was that came out that one of the PIs in question used to claim he was a Rhodes Scholar, and the Rhodes Foundation disagrees. So as a matter of fact, 3 days after that, Duke announced the trials were resuspended, and since then it's been covered in NPR, Science, Nature, the New York Times. We've got an IOM committee that has just been formed to look at things involving new omics signatures, and there have been all sorts of new investigations springing up right and left because, oh gosh, well, the science was bad before, but now that we know that there is resume padding involved, this is a really big deal. But the perhaps bigger question from the scientific point of view is that while this agglomeration of errors is indeed egregious, lots of problems going on here, the individual components are things we've actually seen before. Mislabeling of columns, mislabeling of rows. I don't know how many of you analyze real data. I see that a lot. It's rather scary. And actually, as a consequence, I'm going to leave you some observations here. The most common mistakes, and this is true for all sorts of data, not just high throughput ones, are simple ones. Swapping of column labels, swapping of row labels, etc. However, if they are simple, and I see that, I can fix it. But in a high throughput setting, if the documentation is poor, I very likely won't see it. And if I don't see it, then the converse may apply, and I get very scared that the most simple mistakes are more common in this literature than I would really, really like to admit. So, this is a fixable problem. it is something that we can improve, that we can deal with, and actually we can improve just by making things clearer and more reproducible and insisting upon in high throughput studies and high throughput journals. And again, this is not saying somebody else has to do the same study over again. It's saying, once you start at the numbers, tell us in detail with the code what the heck you did to get from here to here, so that I don't have to go back and reverse engineer it, because that's really frustrating. So I'm going to skip on this one and instead going to acknowledge that I didn't do it all myself. And if those of you who are really curious and you want to learn more, you should read about it in the Annals of Applied Statistics. I will tell you it's a rather atypical statistics paper because there's three equations in it and they're all wrong. But it's a fun read. And with that, I'm going to thank you for your attention. On the lines of being too negative or things like that, there was pushback at some of the funding agencies because they wanted to use these trials more widely, and we were saying no, and we were arguing vehemently against this. So that was one thing. There is another thing, however, which is that from a different point of view about negativity, another problem with a whole bunch of this is getting negative results or counterexamples published. One of my favorite examples comes from this story. It is from a thing to the Lancet Oncology, where we submitted it, and we said, amongst other things, well, they got the sensitive and resistant labels reversed. And the reviewer's response was truly classic, because as part of it, he says, it would appear that you are arguing about a statistical issue to which there is no right or wrong answer. And we just decided, okay, we're giving up on that one, we move from there. But yeah, it's a problem. Other question? Yes.
Do you think more open source publication would help or make it worse?
I think more open source communication. Yes, I think it would help. And I think part of the reason is that right now, a lot of the code just isn't provided, and as a result, if it's not provided, it's not ever checked. We only did this level of digging because people wanted to use it in clinical trials at MD Anderson. And there was actually two or three big groups that wanted to do it. That was important because three big groups mean we can charge time and actually get it done. But the open source stuff, that means I can actually look at the code. Actually, these days, when I review high throughput papers, one of the things I have commented on in some of my reviews is, I like the biological story. I think it's cool. They haven't supplied the code or the data to let other people check it. And until that is supplied, I would recommend this paper not be accepted. So we're trying to, that's my own little way of kicking back, but yes.